From WXXI News, this is Healthy Friday on Connections. I'm Elisa Orlando. I'm here this hour to talk about what happens when we treat disease. A little later in the hour, we'll hear from a health psychologist who studied what happens when people with heart treatments like defibrillators get shocked. How does that impact their quality of life? My first guest, though, is Dr. Gilbert Welch. Dr. Welch is a general internist and a professor of medicine at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Research. He's also the author of several books, all of which discuss the idea that center on the medical world's effort to find diseases and treat them early. In his work, Dr. Welch puts forth that in some cases, doctors may overdiagnose and overtreat. It's a novel concept, especially in a world where prevention is a catchphrase. Many of us have regular screenings for all kinds of diseases, from breast cancer and mammograms to prostate cancer to blood pressure to cholesterol. One of Dr. Welch's books is called Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in Pursuit of Health. He's a guest on the National Public Television show, Second Opinion, produced here in Rochester, New York, and he was in Rochester last week for the production of Second Opinion right here at WXXI. We sat down together and talked about the batches of screening tests that many of us receive as we pass certain age-related milestones. So, Dr. Welch, thanks for being here today. We just talked about a bunch of tests that we all tend to get or ask for as we visit our doctors and as we turn certain ages. You claim that perhaps we get too many screening tests or that we're overtreated in some cases. Isn't the point of prevention to find out what the problems are in our bodies and then fix them as soon as we can so that we're healthier?
Well, the problem is we all harbor abnormalities. And the way our technologies are progressing, they're increasingly able to find them. So it turns out while it apparently would make sense to look for problems early, one of the side effects of looking for problems early is all of a sudden you identify problems that are never going to matter. But the doctors never know which problems are going to matter and which ones aren't going to matter, so they tend to react to all the results. And that's why looking for early forms of disease is a double-edged sword.
All right, so you say we all harbor abnormalities. In other words, I might have, some nodes on my lungs I don't know about but are never going to bother me? Is that the idea?
That's right. You might have lung cancer. You almost certainly have thyroid cancer. You might have breast cancer. I know I have prostate cancer. If we look hard enough, particularly in high turnover organs, we always find abnormal cells. And this has been shown in autopsy studies of people who have died from some other reason. And when pathologists look systematically for early forms of cancer, they find that people harbor a lot of it. And so that's one of the issues that comes with early detection, is all of a sudden you identify a whole new set of people as having the problem that you never knew about before, and many of those people will never go on to actually develop a clinical problem.
So as a consumer, you talking to me as a consumer, you just said you said a lot of sentences that might be really scary to me in one setting.
Yeah.
You have this cancer, you have that cancer. I certainly have prostate cancer, you said. So are you saying that we should not, in effect, look for any of these things?
I think everybody should know that screening is a double-edged sword. There are two sides to it. It has the potential to help some people, very few, honestly, and it has the potential to harm other people because you unearth things that otherwise would never become apparent. And so my main message is that screening is a choice. We being the medical profession, have sort of articulated it as if it was a public health imperative, like it was the most important thing you could do for your health. Well, let's be clear. It is not the most important thing you can do for your health. The most important thing you can do for your health is to eat well and move regularly. And this idea that looking for things to be wrong is the path to a healthy society is something we have to really reconsider.
So, I mean, even when I go into my doctor's office, there's something on the wall that tells me at what age I should do what thing.
Yeah.
Are you saying that I need to sit with my doctor and challenge some of that?
Yes. I think we all need a little bit more of healthy skepticism about the value of so-called anticipatory medicine, trying to guess what might happen in the future. Now, I want to be clear, medicine can do a lot of good for certain people, particularly those who are acutely ill or injured. But the question about what happens to well people and how much doctors can actually help well people as opposed to create problems in well people is a question that we need to further explore, and people need to understand there are two sides to it.
And you address this a little bit in your books. There's one of your books called Less Medicine, More Health, in which you discuss seven assumptions that are driving what you say really, in effect, is too much medical care that people receive. One of those assumptions that we're talking about right now is that early screening, knowing what you have, knowing is always better. You discussed prostate cancer as an example of knowing when knowing it may not always be better. And that idea is in the consciousness a little
there.
Bit coming now, the idea of watchful waiting.
Absolutely.
Is this what you're describing?
Absolutely.
And discuss how this fits into what you think.
And I think we're in the midst of a transition in medicine, and medical transitions takes years to occur. But there are more and more doctors who recognize that some of their patients get too much medicine. And in fact, a recent survey of primary care practitioners revealed almost half of them thought that their patients had too much medical care. So we're in the midst of a rebalance. The problem is greatest in people who aren't sick. And one of the things to remember is it's awfully hard for us to make a well person any better. It isn't hard for us to make them worse. So there's a new cautiousness. And prostate cancer screening is a poster child for the problem. It's where most doctors now recognize that there really is two sides to this this effort to find disease early. You may help a few men, but you lead many other men to have an operation that has real serious side effects for diseases that were never going to bother them. But the idea is not limited to prostate. Prostate cancer is not just one case of the problem. There are multiple cases.
Give me some other examples.
Well, breast cancer is a perfectly good example. And I know this is a world where right now a lot of doctors say, well, prostate cancer screening bad, breast cancer screening good. Truth is, they're not that different. They both have the potential to help a select few of individuals, but they also have the side effect of leading more people to be diagnosed with cancer, more people to be treated for cancer, many of whom are being treated for cancer that would never bother them.
So are you saying that we should maybe not treat for breast cancer as soon as we do?
No, what we shouldn't do is be looking, first, let's be clear, that women who become aware of a new breast lump should go in and see a doctor, and they should have a diagnostic mammogram. No one debates that. We all agree diagnostic mammography is a good thing. The question is whether we should invite all women to come in for us to look hard at them to see if we can find something wrong. Unfortunately, the side effect of that strategy is we find quite a few things wrong. This leads to a lot of worry. It leads to a lot of subsequent procedures, and it leads to some women being treated for breast cancers that were never going to bother them. The cancer in particular that we're most worried about overdiagnosis in is the earliest form of breast cancer, what's called ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS, which now some pathologists who were involved in the original labeling of the disease wish the word carcinoma was never attached to. So we've got this problem. Whenever we look for early forms of disease, we tend to find more people have it than we ever expect. We don't know which ones are going to be for whom this is going to be relevant. We tend to treat them all, and that's why screening is a choice.
So is it not worth it if there is one person for whom it's going to be relevant out there in that crowd of people? Would you say it's still not worth it to do it?
I wouldn't say it's not worth it. I think the question is, this is a personal choice, that different people can look at the data and come to different conclusions. But I will say this, that for years we've sort of focused on the one person in 1,000, say, that we might be able to help. And the question I'm raising is, what happens to the other 999? I think that's important. This isn't a question of money. Even if you had all the money in the world, I think this is a relevant question for people to consider. Because remember, you're much more likely to be in that 999.
All right. One of your assumptions, too, is that it never hurts to get more information. And
sure.
This is something, since you're sitting here right now on a radio program,
sure.
People get a lot of information from the media, from the Internet, and from their physicians. Can you describe what you mean by the fact that we should challenge the idea that it doesn't hurt to get more information?
Sure. And I think this is an important idea, because this is sort of a central tenet of the 21st century. You know, more information is always better. And I think it's a tenet that conflates data with useful knowledge. And those are two very different ideas. It's very easy to collect data. We can collect data on thousands of biochemical variables in your body right now. We can get literally hundreds of thousands of pixels of data about your anatomic body, you know, by cross-sectional imaging, CT scans, et cetera. We can look every few millimeters and examine your body. And the human genome, you got 3 billion data points that we can be collecting. There's a lot of data out there. That doesn't mean it's useful knowledge. And this is one of the things that I think we need to be much more critical about thinking about. What is the point of obtaining the data, particularly if we're not sure exactly what the data means, much less what to do about it? I think it's a recipe for a lot of haphazard subsequent testing and subsequent intervention for things we're really not sure what they mean or what we should do about them.
Where does your doctor fall into that that idea in terms of it never hurts to get more information? Would you say that the doctor wants a lot of data and gets a lot of data and then gets distracted? Or would you say that that we demand from our doctors that we know a lot of things?
I think it's a little of both. I think your question could be rephrased as, who's to blame?
Perhaps.
And there's a lot of people to blame out there. I mean, yes, patients sometimes think uncritically that more information is always in their interest, more data, I should say. Doctors sometimes feel that they need to get data sort of to cover themselves. And then, of course, there's huge financial interests behind this, whether you're talking about imaging data, which, this is x-rays and CTs, which is a large source of revenue for our hospitals and for physicians' offices sometimes. And then the whole testing industry, particularly as we move into genetic tests, there are huge financial interests there to expand that testing to the general population. Of course, there's an interest in that. But I think we need to push back a little bit as patients and ask the question, what question are we trying to answer? How good are the data in answering that question? And once I know the answer to the question, what would I do differently?
Well, I think a lot of us, though, feel as patients or consumers, even if we're well people, that we're not qualified. We don't really know the answers. And even though I think many of us, and I certainly have heard from people listening to this program, that even though we may go out and get a lot of information, that we still trust the doctor to sort of figure it all out for us. And it's in that doctor's office where we have a high degree of trust. We read the paper on the wall that says, get screened for this at this age. And we do that because we don't have the confidence to understand what really is good for us.
Well, I think one of the things that's really important here is to recognize there are two sides to these issues and to go into your doctor and acknowledge that you understand that. And I think many doctors will see that as a breath of fresh air, because a lot of doctors do feel, oh, it's the patients that need to do it, or all the messages they've heard is it's always useful to get another test or to get a genome scan or to get acknowledging that you understand that there's more complexity here, that there's more nuance here, that good things can happen, but so can bad things happen, I think that leads to a much healthier conversation with your doctor. And I think a lot of patients will be surprised particularly if the doctor has time, that the doctor is actually quite sensitive to a lot of these topics.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Gilbert Welch today from Dartmouth Medical School. You're listening to Healthy Friday on WXXI and on WXXI.org. And we're talking about, he's challenging some of our assumptions about prevention and treatment of diseases and health problems. So if you would like to feedback to us in any way, we invite you to come to our Facebook page at WXXINews.org or find WXXI News on Facebook and leave your comments there. You can also hear a podcast of this program coming up later on today on WXXI News. I would like to ask you, Dr. Welch, too, where did this come from in you? When did you, what started these sensibilities in you, and what began your sort of research in this area and your work in this area?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that question. I guess I should start crediting my mother, who was a nurse and went on to be a hospital trustee, and my father was a political scientist, and at the dinner table we were often talking about the politics of medical care. So I was raised in a family where questioning assumptions was an important part of my upbringing. As a medical resident, all of a sudden I saw the kind of problems that could be created in people that didn't have a problem, but when we were pursuing a problem that we thought they had, we could create problems. So that sensitized me to it more. And then I went to Dartmouth, and I started working with a radiologist by the name of William Black, who was trained in the era of the chest X-ray and was undergoing the transformation to the CT scan of the chest. And that was a remarkable transition where all of a sudden you realize that you could see a whole lot more. And when you can see a whole lot more, you find a lot more abnormalities. And that raises the question, what do those new abnormalities mean? And so he was very sensitive to that issue. And I realized that was not simply a problem in radiology. It's a problem throughout all of medicine. As technology changes and has higher resolution, whether it's in terms of biochemistry or genetics or imaging, all of a sudden we can unearth a whole new category of abnormality. And we don't really understand them well, and yet we tend to intervene on them, and that can cause problems.
You even talk about this in the context of heart disease
and
whether people
sure.
should have heart surgery. I think it's, you know, we think of heart disease as being something that's very serious, like cancer, that we want to have it treated. And if we have blockage, we need to deal with it, oftentimes with some of the advances and things that have been tested in evidence. There's evidence-based reason for doing things.
Absolutely. And by the way, if you have a, you know, if I'm having a heart attack, I want a wire and a balloon put into me. There's no question about that. One of the things, though, I think it's very important for people to understand is people are not either diseased or not diseased. There's a lot in between. And that is where we get into trouble. In other words, it's a very different question, someone who's had a heart attack from someone who's never had any heart symptoms but has abnormal arteries of the heart. Those are two very different patients. But we may not have been as good as being, and we haven't probably told the public as well as we should, how different those two patients are in terms of what interventions they need.
And you're talking about treatment here, not necessarily prevention, but if I have coronary artery disease but I haven't had a heart attack and they find it, you're talking about treating
Absolutely. This is the story that I tell in the book, of the difference between having a heart attack and the difference and what happened to President Bush. And President Bush, former President George W. Bush, mm-hmm. who's quite an active man, who's a avid mountain biker. He clears brush on his ranch in Texas. He felt well. He went to the doctor. He got a stress test, and he comes out with a balloon angioplasty for a asymptomatic lesion in his heart, in his coronary arteries. Now, it wasn't just me that criticized that. What was remarkable, how many American doctors, including cardiologists, pointed out that this is American medical care at its worst. There's evidence that that kind of procedure doesn't help anyone live longer, and it's hard to make someone who feels well feel any better.
I want to make a distinction between when we talk about treatment, between what you're talking about in terms of perhaps procedures or surgeries and things that people can do. On this program, physicians have come on this program and said, well, if you're trying to get your cholesterol down, there's only so much you can do with lifestyle. You're not talking about not medicating necessarily. Is that correct?
Well, no, I think it all depends on the context. Mm-hmm. First off, in terms of cholesterol, our whole feelings about cholesterol beginning to change. You know, used to think it was like the most important variable. Now we realize it's one of many variables to think about. We all benefit from more exercise and eating better. We all benefit. I don't think you need a lot of fancy testing to decide that.
Are we all going to do that?
That's a different question. That's a very different question, and that may take, you know, important interventions like how do you make communities walkable? How do you make sure good food? That's a very important.
It's a
whole different show. But those kind of things, that kind of prevention, what I would call health promotion, no one raises any question about. Those are good things. The only question is, how do we get them done? The questions I'm raising about are about a very different strategy, not a health promotion strategy, a strategy of looking hard for things to be wrong in well people. That's a very different strategy. It's a strategy that immediately leads some people to become anxious about their health, unduly so. And it also is a strategy that unearths a lot of abnormalities that lead to a lot of subsequent testing and leads some people to be treated for diseases that will never bother them. That's a very different kettle of fish, and we have to be really careful when we do that.
How are these ideas about prevention and treatment received for you in general? How are you received?
Do people think I'm crazy? Was that the question?
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how your colleagues feel. How do patients feel?
I think a lot of colleagues, quite frankly, are glad I'm saying these things. A lot of doctors have kind of known this for a long time, but they're hesitant to bring it up because it's so counter the prevailing culture that earlier is always better. It's always good to try to look for forms of disease. But many doctors understand that there are two sides to the problem and that we can go way too far on it. By the way, just to give you an idea of how far wrong people can go in the country of South Korea, the doctors there added on a quick screening test of the thyroid, and all of a sudden, 10 years later, they had a 15-fold increase in thyroid cancer rates. It wasn't a real increase in cancer. The death rate was totally flat, but all of a sudden, 15 times more people had their thyroid out. That was an epidemic of overdiagnosis. And this is the kind of problem we can get in if we start looking too hard for things to be wrong.
Are you are there certain types of screenings, though, or diseases that you think we should be looking for? Are there some exceptions your thought pattern here?
I think that the nuance is to understand that the people who stand to benefit the most from screening are those at the very highest risk of the disease. And so, obviously, the screening test, where it's easiest to identify a really high-risk population, is in lung cancer and heavy smokers. And that is why that is the screening test that appears to actually be the first screening test that has a change in the overall life expectancy of the patient. Death for any reason, because lung cancer death is a relatively large portion of the mortality for a smoker. So that general feature, very high risk, women with BRCA1 or 2, for example, screening for cancer, that's a totally different, totally separate group of patients. As far as general population screening, we're always going to be facing this balance, this trade-off of maybe helping a few and maybe leaving, and without a doubt, leading others to be treated unnecessarily. There, I'd say it's a personal choice, and people need to understand why it's a personal choice and how close the calls really are.
And we must have to know if it's a person, if we decide that we're going to make this more, we're going to get more involved in this in our choices, we probably have to know more about our own family history, for example. We have to understand if I, as an individual, am at risk for more things. Is that accurate?
That's right. And you have to learn a little bit more about the tests and some of the debates about them.
I also wonder if this doesn't mean that our physician has to know us really well, if in fact this is about individuals, risk, and choices. And that's something that I think as Americans, we think we don't have much, we don't think our physicians know us that well.
We don't have that much
time with them anymore.
No, and in some ways, all this effort to looking for early forms of disease interferes with this very basic question of getting to know your physician. I mean, it can be a huge distraction where your physician is always focused on test results instead of actually talking to you and seeing how you feel. And I think this is one place where our effort to look for early forms of disease has ironically distracted and interfered with the relationship between a patient and their physician, because physicians are now just fluttering around test results.
In addition to looking for disease and being able to find it more easily than we did because of new technologies and innovations, Dr. Gilbert Welch, there are also a lot of new treatments. It seems like there are always new treatments, especially being mentioned in the media.
Yeah.
And why is it that newer is not necessarily better, isn't newer better?
Well, this is this is another part of being a skeptical consumer, because sometimes new is better. But to be clear, the main thing you know about new is it's probably not well tested. And this is particularly true of new drugs. It takes us a while for us to understand the full effects of drugs. And that's why if I need to be put on a medication, I'd like to be put on a medication that's been around for a while, that we have some track record with, the FDA has been following for years. And because some medicines come on the market, big advertising push, then are withdrawn, 5-10 years later when they realize there's a substantial side effect, of Vioxx being a classic example of that some of your listeners will remember. Same's true of new procedures. Sometimes new procedures come out with lots of favorable press, and when they're rigorously evaluated, they're found to be no better, or in fact worse, as was the case with autologous bone marrow transplantation for women with metastatic breast cancer. And the new devices, and the example I give in the book is the metal-on-metal hip, which was supposed to be a great leap forward until we all recognized that it began to create more problems than it solved and led to more hip replacements having to be revised because of the problems created by the metal ions. So I think in general, when you have a problem that does warrant treatment, you'd like to go with the treatment that your doctor knows, that we have some experience with, and that we know works.
Boy, it's just so hard these days when things are wrong with folks, whether they're serious or you know, moderately serious, less serious, or obviously when it's very serious and acute, you're going to be treated and you're going to, that's when I have the most trust in my physician.
Absolutely.
And my healthcare team.
And that's, by the way, if I can, that's when you should most interface with the healthcare system, when you have an acute injury, acute illness, and then you need to trust your doctor. You're not making decisions. But most of medicine isn't that.
Right, and in most of these cases, those, most of us, we want to be fixed. We want it to get better, or we want to feel better, or we want to take care of the problem. I can't imagine that it's going to be hard to change that thought process for American patients.
I think it is a challenge, and I think just because it's challenging doesn't mean we shouldn't try to do things right. I think one thing people, and ironically, we may have lost confidence in our own body's ability to heal. And sometimes intervening on things such as back pain can actually interfere with our ability to heal. So we all need to understand, have a little bit more nuanced relationship with medical care. You know, some of it is good, and I want to, you know, make sure I emphasize that point. But at the same time, we should recognize that you can get too much, and particularly when you don't have any problems.
All right, Dr. Gilbert Welch is a professor at Dartmouth Medical School. He is a guest this season on WXXI's television program, Second Opinion, so you can see him when we begin our season in the fall. Also author of many books, including Less Medicine, More Health. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read more about this story on WXXINews.org. You can also hear a podcast of this program on WXXINews.org. Just click on the Connections program. Look for Healthy Friday in the podcast link. I'm Elisa Orlando. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more of Healthy Friday right after this. You're listening to member-supported public radio.
Hours after a gunman opened fire in a Charleston church, Attorney General Loretta Lynch made this announcement.
The Department of Justice has opened a hate crime investigation into this shooting incident. Acts like this one have no place in our country and no place in a civilized society.
A closer look at the prosecution of hate crimes later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Healthy Friday. I'm Elisa Orlando. My next guest is Dr. Sam Sears from East Carolina University. Dr. Sears is a health psychologist. He's embedded, if you will, in a cardiac unit. He's a PhD in the Departments of Psychology and Cardiovascular Sciences at East Carolina. Dr. Sears and his colleagues recently completed a study of how treatments for heart disease, device treatments, affect people's behavior. We started with an understanding of various devices like pacemakers and defibrillators.
Pacemakers have been around since the 1950s. They focus on treating slow heart rates. Defibrillators, FDA approved in 1985, focus on heart rates that are fast and irregular. Pacemakers improve the quality of life by helping people be able to do more than their sort of native pacemaker would allow. But implantable defibrillators save lives. ICDs focus on irregular heartbeats that will lead to a potentially life-threatening situation in very short order. So roughly speaking, a ventricular fibrillation event results in death in 10 minutes or less. In 5 minutes or less, we have neurologic problems. And so we need a rapid solution to an irregular heartbeat that can only be provided electrically.
All right. And an ICD is a bigger, in size, it's a bigger piece of equipment, correct? And
it is. It's a bigger piece of equipment because it has to amass a large amount of electricity in a short period of time.
So your study dealt with the effect of having these devices. And I think that I have to say that before you and I started speaking about this particular study, pretty much the only thing that we hear as consumers or patients about these devices is that they're lifesavers. They keep your heart at a certain pace. Heart issues are so critical, and heart attacks are such critical situations that we don't think that there might be anything wrong with them, perhaps, as consumers. Not that there's anything wrong with the devices, but your study talked about what is the impact on patients and their activity in their lives. So, mm-hmm. would you describe why you wanted to study this and what it concluded?
Yeah, so quality of life is the metric we care most about as consumers. We want to prevent premature death, but being able to live the kind of life we want is critical. The kind of life we want usually involves being able to be active to some level and engage in our life. We wanted to study this because the defibrillator has in it an accelerometer, a ability to detect activity. And so we were able to look with a high level of scientific precision how well people have returned to life. And some of the findings are surprising to us.
Tell me why they were surprising.
Well, I think the main reason we thought it was surprising, that the average heart patient with a defibrillator engages in a relatively low amount of movement, not just physical activity or exertion, but movement. What we showed was that the average patient with a defibrillator in this study was moving a total of approximately 3 hours a day. What that means is that 21 hours a day, the average patient is pretty much still. Now, you'd expect that if they were, like, homebound or bedridden. But 21 hours is actually a lot of time every day on average to be not moving. This doesn't go anywhere near exertion. This just goes at moving at all. Yeah.
All right. Did you also look at pacemaker patients?
We did not look at pacemaker patients in this particular study, although we think that this kind of technology is available in other devices. So we are moving toward other kinds of accelerometer-based approaches to understanding how much do different kinds of patients move.
You looked at a period of time after a patient had been shocked or after the defibrillator had been used in some way, correct?
Correct.
How long did you look at them for?
Yeah, so this was a large study that we took a subset of the patients to study. So specifically what we wanted to know was, If you use the pacing features of the device to break up an arrhythmia, did they differ than those who used the high-energy shock to break up the arrhythmia? And what we showed was that those who we used the sort of painless therapy had no change in their activity, but those in which we had to go to the higher-level shock, those patients, in fact, later become even more disengaged from any movement.
This is sounding like it kind of makes sense to me. If I felt a shock, I might be really nervous about moving around for quite a while.
Yeah.
That's
exactly right.
Is that oversimplifying it?
Yeah, no, it's spot on because avoidance behavior, somehow thinking that, well, maybe if I just don't do very much or ask very much of my heart, I'll be able to avoid a problem. But in fact, what happens is as you avoid an activity, you actually create a new problem called no quality of life. Mm-hmm. Not doing anything is no fun. And so It's a dirty trick. What protects you in the short run detracts from you in the long run.
So what do you felt like you learned in the study, in your field, because you're dealing with different issues than a physician?
I think what we're learning best and being able to communicate to both patients and physicians who take care of them is that a patient's daily activity is a very important marker to how well the adjustment to the disease and how well the lifestyle is sustained. So basically, previously, we were looking at things like anxiety, which is very important for its own sake. But honestly, some healthcare providers go, anxiety, you don't die from anxiety. Yeah, that's right. But anxiety does steal quality of life from you. And so we were able to use this behavioral measure of likely a pretty close proximal measure of anxiety that is more objective as a demonstration that quality of life is being reduced when patients encounter shocks.
I kind of feel as a layperson that even the words quality of life may not have a ton of meaning, or that the meaning gets lost over time as we talk about it sort of in the abstract. It seems a little ironic to me that one of the first things you said is that, you know, patients with pacemakers or devices can do more.
Yeah.
And the irony is that they're not really doing very much more once they have experienced
Exactly.
The sort of relationship, I guess, with the defibrillator. Now, you looked at it a week after, right? So do you think that over time maybe this will subside? Maybe if somebody with an ICD goes for a while without having a shock, they'll feel a little bit more trusting of the whole situation, same with the pacemaker idea, or with when they don't feel it, do you think that they'll get more active?
Well, there's a temptation to say time will heal, and the ghost variable when you talk about time is people are learning how to cope as they go with time. So it's not simply time elapsing, it's actually people testing the limits or testing the waters of activity and then finding, oh, okay, nothing bad happened. So yeah, we do think that there's some improvement over time, but it doesn't look like people get all the way back to their baseline level of activity, that there's something about being shocked that leads people to be very cautious for a long period of time. And I think that's where we're paying attention. The other thing is that I think we have to pay more and more attention to heart patients to address the psychologic and behavioral aspects of recovery. We're good at saying, well, you didn't die. Yeah, but I don't know for sure if I can live, not the way I did before. And that's the challenge for modern medicine, I think, is to really build systems in which people don't have the stigma of asking for help mentally, but rather say, hey, everybody who goes through a heart condition takes a hit physically and mentally, so you shouldn't be expected to just simply waltz out the door and say, wow, I feel great again. But rather we say, you know, the experiences you went through, they were scary, and so taking steps of mental recovery matters too.
Right, we're talking with Dr. Sam Sears today. He's a health psychologist, essentially. He's at East Carolina University, and he works, you're embedded, actually, in a cardiology unit.
Yes.
At East Carolina. So let me ask you this, since what we're discussing today really are, I guess you can correct me if I'm wrong, the negative consequences of life-saving therapy in some cases. How do cardiologists grapple with the idea that there are negative consequences to these things that are keeping us alive?
I think cardiologists mean well, but often don't know how to proceed. Cardiologists are used to getting in and fixing things. They don't understand when everything's not fixed. Psychologic treatments, psychologic care is often not as easily integrated as it has been in East Carolina. They often don't have a good mental health colleague to rely and refer to. And so they often throw up their hands and say, there's nobody who can really help my patients. Yeah, I acknowledge the need, but I don't know what to do. And so I don't think cardiologists are necessarily at fault here. I think it's just our system is very fragmented. And as we move toward changes in our healthcare system that will look at more integrated type care systems where the mind, body, spirit are more tightly addressed, I think we'll see better outcomes. The data suggests that we should, but those kind of large-scale interventions or integrated care systems are few and far between right now.
And do you think that patients understand both sides of the issue, especially when you're very sick and you need something like this? It seems to me that it may be rarely that somebody sits down and says, look, you may have negative side effects. Your quality of life might not be what you might be thinking that it's going to be right now, that maybe getting back there may not happen in the way that you think it's going to.
Yeah, I do think those conversations are less frequent simply because all providers want to maintain a guarded optimism and a positive expectancy. We have seen some slight changes, though, across the country in terms of people paying attention to at least depression following heart disease. So we know that becomes a pretty common conversation now. At least somebody says to the heart patient or to the heart family saying, hey, you may notice mom or dad may have a little bit of adjustment here and there. They may feel kind of sad afterward for a little while. And so there's a little more normativeness about living with heart disease or recovery process now. So I think we have some reason for optimism. There is some movement there. I think if I could change that discussion a little bit, I would add anxiety as the more common challenge that most patients face and anxiety for the spouse. Our data suggests that spouses may and sometimes have it worse than the patient themselves.
And I would assume that what you're concluding then is that the potential of these devices is probably not being realized at this point. Is that accurate to say?
You know, I love the way you ask that, because to me, optimal medical care means give me the best technology, give me the best healthcare providers, and then help me walk out the door ready to be confident and re-engaged in life. Honestly, that's the passion of my work, what you just asked me. I think this is a fantastic technology. It prevents premature death. But we have to launch people with these medical technologies informed, empowered, monitored, so that they go forward and say, I can do this again. I think that's when we do that, we've got the home run of healthcare. When we say, boy, you had a life-threatening condition, we put a device in place to watch it and prevent it, and you're back being the guy you used to be or being the woman that you used to be, engaged in your family, engaged in the roles of your life in your community, and not somehow crippled psychologically by this medical condition. To me, that's a home run. That's what I look for. That's what it gets me up in the morning.
All right, Dr. Sam Sears, let me ask a little bit about going back to the idea of your work, the idea that you're sort of embedded in a group, a cardiology unit. There is some more attention paid these days to things like perhaps anxiety or depression around cardiac issues. But also sometimes these issues of anxiety, depression, or psychological issues around disease might be dealt with in the mental health arena alongside the physical health arena. How do you feel about that? At least people maybe get some help, but not alongside their primary care doctor, perhaps.
Well, historically in this country, mental health policy was a carve-out. They carved it out because it wasn't getting paid attention to well enough in the medical setting. Now, in the last 10 years or so, now we're seeing a carving back in of mental health and people recognizing that most diseases, most chronic diseases that people have to deal with do have a psychological or a behavioral component. And so whether you're talking about chronic pain, whether you're talking about insomnia, whether you're talking about cancer, you're talking about women's health issues or any number of disease states, those conditions happen to people, and people have emotions and reactions to them. And how they react, how adaptive, how informed they respond may in fact very much relate to the outcome of the disease. And it certainly relates to cost of the care of them. And of course, boy, you know, talk about American healthcare, we got to talk about cost. And so psychological aspects have been associated with differences in cost. So problems psychologically, either distressed or non-adherent to the medical regimen, those things are associated with cost and outcomes.
So we've been talking about some of the not very well realized side effects of implantation therapy when it comes to cardiac issues. Have you known patients who have dealt with these issues really well, who have said, oh yeah, I got a shock and I'm not afraid, or who have successfully moved through? And we've talked about how this negatively affects quality of life, but have you known patients who have been able to move through the anxiety, move through the experience, and come out on the other side sort of better?
Oh, no question. I mean, we've done those studies, so we know the characteristics that work. But I can tell you just a simple summary is that the process of cardiac rehabilitation is sort of a wonder drug that doesn't get used. That is cardiac rehab, helping people learn about their condition and then become physically active again and essentially test the limits. Rather than being fearful, they're engaged. And cardiac rehab is very much associated with positive return to work, return to living, and return to lifestyle. So cardiac rehab is I think, the quick and dirty answer.
Why do you say it doesn't get used?
So if you look at the data in cardiac rehab, the vast majority of patients with a heart condition that cardiac rehab would benefit are not referred. And then of those who are referred, and even fewer of those patients end up completing cardiac rehab. So it turns out to be kind of a treatment modality that gets left behind, in part because cardiologists are, I think the patient's going to do fine on their own, when in fact, a steady referral stream to cardiac rehab, and that multidisciplinary care seems to really be critical. And guess who? Women are often the ones not referred. So, again, the problem is uniform. That is way less than half of the patients who could benefit from cardiac rehab get referred, and about half of those end up ever really going and getting the benefit. So it's just an underutilized, powerful, efficacious intervention.
And you describe it as something that one could use to test the limits.
So
you get better, and then you push it a little bit. And I think these are words that we don't hear when we think, I've got a serious heart problem.
Yeah, you're right. I think we all sort of worry about test the limits. Oh, let's be cautious instead. We do need to be cautious. You do need that. But the heart's a muscle. And recovery from the heart, recovery from heart problems and optimizing function means that you do have to follow medical advice, and that often includes, almost always includes, becoming active again. It really is a critical element of recovery. It's also kind of newsworthy. I mean, 40 years ago, we thought maybe you need to go lay down. So
right.
There's been a change in the paradigm of heart patients so that we expect them to be more active. We expect them to be engaged. People live with heart disease now. In the past, they didn't have to learn how to cope. They just passed away, frankly. So today, they live and they engage. And when it's done right, we strike that home run of health recovery. And I think that's the goal that I have as a psychologist communicating about the recovery process. It is to fully recognize cardiologist's role in taking care of the patients, and then the second part of that is reengaging patients to return to their life as they knew it.
Dr. Sam Sears, East Carolina University, thanks so much for being with us today on Healthy Friday.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you very much.
We appreciate your time, and you can see Dr. Sears on an episode of Second Opinion coming up this fall on WXXI television. He appears in our episode about a sudden cardiac arrest. You can also hear a podcast of this episode or share this episode of Healthy Friday. You can find it on the Connections webpage at WXXINews.org. A reminder, the information on Healthy Friday is just that, information, not medical advice. If you have a health care concern, please see your primary care physician or health care provider. I'm Elisa Orlando. Don't forget to listen all next week to WXXI and WRUR for coverage of the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. Look for news stories, music, and interviews throughout the week, and keep up to date at WXXI.org. You're listening to WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS in Geneva. And for our last story today, we're going to talk about a men's health conference that's happening here in Rochester and the importance of keeping the men in our community healthy.
Hours after a gunman opened fire in a Charleston church, Attorney General Loretta Lynch made this announcement.
The Department of Justice has opened a hate crime investigation into this shooting incident. Acts like this one have no place in our country and no place in a civilized society.
A closer look at the prosecution of hate crimes later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Healthy Friday. Here's a statistic. In 1980s, the average life expectancy for African American men in the United States was below retirement age. In an article in the Journal of Men's Health and Gender, an editorial claims that in the United States, African American men have the highest death rates per 100,000 population due to heart diseases, cancer, homicide, AIDS, kidney disease, liver disease, and many other leading causes of death. In general, Americans appear to be paying more attention to men's health issues than they have in the past as well. In our last discussion, for example, we talked about prostate cancer. This weekend, the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition is inviting the public to a conference called We're in This Together. It's a men's health conference, and it's taking place at the New Life Fellowship on Saturday, June 20th. Today, we're going to talk about this event and the coalition with Phyllis Jackson. Phyllis is a registered nurse and a community engagement specialist at the Finger Lakes Health Systems Agency in Rochester. She's originally from Geneva, for our Geneva listeners, and she's an organizer of the Men's Health Conference coming up this Saturday. We should say that several men wanted to participate in this interview today, but their schedules prevented it. And one of those was Dr. John Joseph, a professor in the Department of Urology at URMC. So, Phyllis Jackson, let me ask you a question. Dr. Joseph is just one of the people who's participating in the health conference. There are several healthcare providers that will be there this weekend, correct?
Yes, sir. You're absolutely correct. We have Dr. Gavin, James Gavin, who is the CEO of Healing Our Village in Atlanta, Georgia. He's an internationally known endocrinologist who specializes in diabetes and on the staff of Emory University. We have Dr. Noel from the University of Rochester. We have Dr. Mark Brown, who is a family care practitioner here in Rochester with Dr. Bears Jefferson Family Medicine. So we have some great presenters from the health field, and we have Mr. Radford from Rochester, from Buffalo, and we have some local men, Mr. Isaac Washington, who is going to present there, and Sean Brown, who's also going to be a presenter to the youth.
So some of the people that are going to be participating in this health conference are not healthcare providers. They're going to talk about their experiences as lay people, as men working with the health systems, as patients in some cases. These are not things, I've been a health reporter for many years, and I can tell you from my own experience, these are not things that we tend to usually hear men talking about that much. Is that accurate? Would you share that view?
It's absolutely accurate. Studies have shown that men don't talk about their issues. But one of the strategies of the Men Health Network has been to engage men in peer support groups, and that seems to be working. So the idea of getting men together to talk to each other is one of the strategies that we're using, and we think that having this conference supports that strategy.
And that's Phyllis Jackson, one of the organizers of the Interdenominational Health Ministry Coalition's Men's Health Conference. It's called We're In This Together, and it takes place tomorrow. The event is free. It goes on all day, and registration is required, though. You can call 234-0623 to learn more about the Men's Health Conference. It takes place at New Life Fellowship. Thanks again for joining us for Healthy Friday. Evan Dawson returns next week for Connections. Science Friday comes up next, and All Things Considered is here at 4 p.m. today. I'm Elisa Orlando. You're listening to member-supported public radio, and we'll talk to you next month.